if they get it wrong, I mean, if they make things worse with government responses to these things, then it could be the worst thing we've seen in our lifetime. Certainly, it could be something like a combination of the Great Depression and Weimar Germany or something like that, very easily based on the numbers.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Coal miners were famous for bringing canaries down into the mines with them, as the birds served as an early warning system for poisonous gases. If the canary suddenly died, that was an important signal for the miners to drop everything and rush back to the surface. Today's guest expert, macro analyst John Rubino, has shared with us in the past the early warning indicator he watches closely to alert him when a recession is likely about to hit. And that indicator has suddenly started flashing a bright warning. What's the indicator, and what's it telling us to expect? To find out, we'll ask him directly. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Adam, thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you again.
Great. Well, John, look, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. You're a highly requested guest by the audience here, but you're also a good friend. We have lots of great discussions, on our own, off channel. But it's always fun to have you back on and dive into things. And this one's going to be really fun because we had you on this channel, gosh, I don't know, almost a year ago when we were talking about experts' brown M&Ms. And that's a reference back to the old Ryder and the Van Halen contract. You know, when they would show up at a venue, they demanded that there be a bowl with all the brown M&Ms removed. And everybody thought that they were big prima donnas, but it was genius because they had such a complicated technological show with pyrotechnics where people could get injured. They wanted to make sure that the venue that they were showing up at, that the people there had read the contract really closely. And so they could just look at that bowl. And if they saw brown M&Ms in it, they would say, hey, these guys didn't set the venue up well. We have to check everything. So back when when I asked you, what are some of your brown M&Ms, you told us what your indicator is, which I'm going to keep people in suspense about for just another minute. Because before we get to it, I do just want to start with a question I normally ask all my guests at the beginning, which is, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, the world in general is a horrendous mess right now. We've been making terrible mistakes since at least the 1970s. And there are those who would say that the mistakes go back to 1913 with the formation of the Fed. But basically, we've been in recent years borrowing way too much money and encouraging basically everybody else to leverage in one way or another. So you got massively indebted governments and then corporations and then individuals all with too much debt right now. And that always leads to trouble, whether it's, whether you're an individual or a corporation or a government. When you borrow too much, your life spins out of control. And we are really, for the first time in human history, in that situation globally now. It used to be that one country or another would make some big mistakes, blow up their currency, have a gigantic crisis, whatever. But that would be in the context of a sound money world where everybody else was back, was on the gold standard, and therefore basically okay financially. But now everybody has a fiat currency printing press, and they're all abusing that privilege. So when the consequences come home, and you can make the argument that they already are, we've got inflation, yada, yada, going on right now that will lead to a lot of trouble. But when the serious problems hit from all of this, it'll be the first time that it's global in scale and in scope. And so that's going to make it very different and hard to predict. But I think you can say with certainty that right now, the global financial system is in very bad shape and headed for worse shape.
Okay. That's a big statement. I'm sure people want me to dig into it with you, and I'm going to. First, though, I want to go over to your early warning indicator, your canary in the coal mine that I referenced in the introduction. That indicator that you have shared with us in the past that you've watched closely to try to get a sense for when we are going to tip from, what's been sort of an era of relative prosperity coming out of the global financial crisis, where tons of stimulus was being pumped into the system, asset prices pretty much went straight up for the better part of more than a decade. People have been feeling increasingly flush. And one of the things that a lot of people did when they felt flush was go out and buy RVs. And the pandemic, when it sort of shut the world down, you know, offices were closed and people were being sent checks in the mail and whatnot. Boy, RV sales kind of went through the roof as everybody wanted to try to, you know, have a COVID safe way to get out of home. And also they had that extra cash sort of sloshing around. So I know you've been watching that indicator closely to see that, you know, is that strong buying demand going to peak and maybe start coming down? And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons kind of why you watch this is in past economic cycles, yeah, when people feel good, they go out and they buy big toys like this. And then when we enter the bust cycle, obviously the demand dries up and then you can pick these things up, you know, at the bottom of a cycle for a song. So what are the indicators telling you right now in the RV space about where we're headed economically?
Well, they're rolling over again. And you know, I should say that I've spent the last 30 or so years living more or less in suburbs where the RV ends up being the biggest toy that people buy at the peak of the cycle. You know, when they've got a boat, they've got motorcycles and jet skis and a big house, all that stuff. And they still have extra money, or at least still have extra credit. They go out and they buy a house that you can drive from place to place, which is a, you know, patently absurd idea just on the surface. But it is a good cyclical indicator because it's usually the last thing people buy. RV sales boom towards the end of credit expansions and then collapse on the other side of it, you know, and so the lesson from that is twofold, really. You know, it's a sign of what's happening with the economy, and it's also a sign of when you should be buying an RV. Do not buy one at the peak when the prices are going up. But in the depths of a recession, people have to give their big toys away just about because they run out of credit. They can't cover their car loan and their motorcycle loan and their jet skis and all that. That's when you buy these things. So this would be a time when you probably still don't want to be buying an RV because we're still at kind of elevated price levels, but they're starting to roll over along with, I would argue, the rest of the economy. You know, we're headed into a recession, it seems. And a lot of other indicators point in that direction, but the RV indicator definitely does. You told me that you saw an ad for an RV that was $30,000 or $40,000 below MSRP. That's the kind of thing you see just as the cycle turns and sales dry up and prices start to get cut. So if we're seeing that now, then you can add the RV indicator to all the other indicators that say we're heading into a recession.
Yeah, it's funny. You're right. I had a friend who's sort of been monitoring RV prices, basically largely based upon your earlier video on this channel from, like I said, about 8 months ago or so, where you were talking about this indicator. So he contacts the local dealership and just sort of, you know, every so often asks them, hey, where are prices right now? Well, now the dealership actually reached out to him and said, hey, we know you've been calling from time to time. We have a floor model here that, you know, we're pricing for a song right now. So if you're interested, come on in. And he said, no, that's okay. I think the RV market's actually got a little further to fall. So I'm going to wait, but just curious, what's the price of the model you're talking about? The guy said it's a MSRP of $133,000. And they're going to offer it to my friend for the low price of $89,999. So that's already a pretty substantial discount there. What I'm doing the math in my head, but it's getting close to like a 35, 40% haircut that they're putting on MSRP right now. And again, this knife may still be falling, so it may still have a lot further to fall from here.
Well, yeah, at the bottom of the cycle, they'll give you that RV for 50, and they'll throw in a car that you can attach to the back of the RV to take with you. Since you're driving your house, you might as well take another car too. So you bring your entire suburban lifestyle with you to wherever you go. And you know, that's true of all the other big toys. Pickup trucks, only buy pickup trucks at the very bottom of a recession, and motorcycles, et cetera, et cetera. And we're nowhere near that yet. We're just starting to take some baby steps in that direction. So when this really gets going, it'll be a completely different thing. Most of your audience probably remembers 2008, 2009, because it was so recent, but that was apocalyptic for a little while. And based on the numbers, something much worse than that should be coming. So when you're thinking about indicators and you're thinking, if you're thinking about buying a big toy, keep that in mind, that that things are going to get much, much worse as somehow, some way, all of this debt gets worked off. And every indicator, at the very bottom, every indicator is going to look like end of the world. And the prices of things that people are trying to sell will seem like Great Depression events, you know, where these people are going broke and they just have to get rid of something no matter what, just take it away. You know, that's the way it's going to be. And, the RV thing is kind of that. It's an indicator of that whole thing with a little bit of Schadenfreude thrown in, because, at least this is, again, I'm talking about my own personal experience here. You know, I used to feel kind of jealous when I'd see my neighbors buy these 40-foot RVs in the driveway, and my kids thought they were so cool and wanted to play in them and everything. And, you know, I never felt comfortable owning something like that, but I did feel jealous of the people that did own them. So there's always a kind of a sense of justification when we have a down cycle like this, and all of those guys have to sell their big giant toys.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're not, I know what you're talking about, you're not necessarily delighting in someone else's pain, but you're sort of welcoming the return of rationality back to the world, right? Where, all right, you know what? We all know we shouldn't be living outside of our means and, you know, spending ridiculous amounts of money for toys that it's sort of the land boat, right? I mean, if you own a sailboat, the thing is just a money pit, right? And it's not that you shouldn't own sailboats or whatnot, but you shouldn't basically be, you know, overextending the way that people tend to with these toys in the late stage of the cycles. And people that are more rationally minded like you and I, it just, you get angry at the fact that it works as long as it does for people, when we know that it's not sustainable, right? And then when that sustainability starts re-expressing itself, there is a little bit of a, okay, well, thank goodness the world's starting to make sense again.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it. I'm not taking pleasure in watching this happen to everybody. But it is nice to see a return of sanity. I kind of am taking pleasure sometimes in watching people who throw money around like crazy get what's coming to them. But
all right, so another kind of related indicator though the town I used to live in, and even to a certain extent the town I'm in now. There are parts of town that when you go through an economic downturn, people start parking their cars or their RVs even, right, with the big for sale signs on them, right? It kind of becomes like a de facto used car parking lot, right? But it's just where everybody in town has agreed, okay, this is where we're going to park our stuff during the day to try to sell it, right? And I'm beginning to see cars pop up around town with for sale signs on, which when I started to see it, it made me realize how long it had been since I had seen them before, because we've had this really pretty long stretch of prosperity. But gosh, I mean, I remember that the last town I used to live in down in Palo Alto, there's kind of a stretch of El Camino where people do this. And I remember during the dot-com bust how, I mean, it was about as far as you could see down the road, just, you know, cars with for sale signs on them, because everybody was having to dump, you know, all these expensive cars that they had overstretched to buy beforehand. I'm beginning to see, like I said, a little bit of that begin to creep in where I am right now. But it's sort of another one of those indicators that just we as regular people, in addition to all the financial data that we see on our screens, that we can just look at in our real lives as kind of a barometer for where we are in the story.
Yeah. And we're nowhere near the bottom of anything yet. Like you and Wolf Richter were talking about a week or so ago, the economy is actually surprisingly strong in a lot of ways, considering all the reasons that it should be weak. And today they just reported the Fed's favorite inflation measure went up. So inflation is actually accelerating according to that measure. We're not in a recession. And a lot of the signs, like the for sale signs in that parking lot you were talking about, are not that plentiful yet. But there are a lot of reasons to think that that day is coming fairly quickly. There's a lot of other indicators that that are more behind the scenes than, say, for sale signs. So you don't notice them when they're just kind of bubbling out there and getting ready to work their way into the real economy. But a lot of those are pointing down now at a steeper and steeper rate. So I think as more and more things roll over, then the overall picture that most people have of the economy is going to be a lot more negative, and the big numbers are going to reflect that. So I think that's the second half of this year's story. And I think it's reasonable to predict that by the end of this year, we'll be in an official recession. And the question will be, when does the Fed start cutting interest rates? So
okay,
we're going to
Let's dig into that. And I want to just use as the jumping off point into that discussion. It's a really weird time right now, because like you said, there's just a ton of indicators, you know, leading economic indicators, rising consumer debt, falling savings rate, declining real wages. I mean, we can go through a whole ton of them. And I'm sure we're about to talk about a bunch of these macro factors. But at the same time, you've got stock market up, you know, 9%+ this year. You've got the NASDAQ up over 25%. You've got NVIDIA up like over 200% since the October lows. In fact, we actually have kind of a bubble going on right now in AI stocks. And the biggest stocks, the biggest companies that are involved in AI happen to be those like top 10 stocks that, you know, oftentimes referred to as the FANG stocks, that are kind of pulling the market indices up with them as they rage right now. And so it's a weird time, because you can see this euphoric party going on in the markets where they're just pricing in wonderful days ahead of us. But then you can turn and look at all this other data that you just referenced to and say, my God, it looks like we might be going off a cliff later this year, right? So it's just such a weird time right now. I know that a lot of investors are really caught between, which do I believe? Because in a real sense, people are making a lot of money today in certain stocks. And while they're fearful of what might be coming ahead with the grim data you referenced, they also have, you know, FOMO starting to come back of like, but my idiot friend is making a ton of money right now. Why am I missing out on that party? So I wonder if you could sort of speak to this very schizophrenic time that we're in right now.
Yeah, the headlines do not seem recessionary, really. And one thing we could say about the stock market, two things really. One is NVIDIA is a serious short candidate right now. You know, I'm really tempted. And the other is that market breadth, which is, you know, how are the average stocks doing, not just the handful of great stocks, is the worst it's ever been, just about. There are just this tiny handful of stocks pulling the rest of the broad market averages up. And historically, that's the end of a cycle. You know, when breadth gets narrower and narrower and narrower, eventually a few of those stocks, a few of the stocks that are doing great, stop doing great, in part because they're just overvalued. You know, they roll over and then that pulls everything else down. And then you get that bear market that coincides with a recession. So this is normal. It's normal for market breadth to contract and a few stocks to do great right at the end of the cycle.
Hey, can I just interrupt it? So you say this is a cyclical story we see, right? Where at the end of the cycle, market breadth continues to narrow until it's just in a few stocks, and then they tumble, and then everything goes into the corrective phase. It sort of sounds a lot like, you know, the sinking ship at sea, right? Where you know, the nose of the ship goes under the water, but the stern is actually rising, and everybody rushes up into the stern, of course, because it's above water. And even though the stern is rising, yeah, for a brief period of time, you know, it's still going up, but then eventually it slips under the water like everything else before it did. And it brings all the people that got concentrated up in there down with it when it finally goes under. Is that an apt analogy?
That's a good visual for something that's a non-visual phenomenon. But yeah, that's basically how it works. And I think the overriding thing, we can go through some specific indicators of imminent trouble, but I think the biggest thing to pay attention to now is the money supply. We are shrinking the M2 money supply, at least. for the first time, for as far back as a lot of the charts go. You know, we just don't normally have a shrinking money supply in a fiat currency system, because a fiat currency system is basically a Ponzi scheme.
It must grow.
New money. Yeah, the money supply has to grow to cover all the interest that has to be paid off. You know, interest charges go up along with debt year after year after year. You need more money coming in to pay those off. When the money supply starts to shrink, that means a growing number of people out there can't get the new credit in order to cover their interest costs, and they start to go bust. And that's how a Ponzi scheme finally blows up, when the new money coming in is inadequate to cover the payouts to the existing investors. Well, we've got that going on right now. And unless the money supply would start to increase dramatically from here, there's no alternative but to a lot of different overleveraged entities blowing up in the not too distant future. And there's nothing happening to make the money supply go up now. Interest rates are still rising. The Fed is still shrinking its balance sheet. So we're still in quantitative tightening, which means the money supply is going to continue to decrease, which means lots of people are going to blow up here pretty soon. You know, this economy is full of financial zombies, whether they're individuals or corporations or even some governments. And they're just not going to be able to make their payments at some point in the future. So leaving everything else aside, what stocks are doing, what the housing market is doing, what car prices are doing, a shrinking money supply in a fiat currency system means big trouble out there. So that's almost all we have to look at to know that at some point, something really big has to change. Either the Fed has to start flooding the system with money again, or we get, you know, that little mini banking crisis we had just lately on steroids, just writ large, and the insurance companies and the pension funds and the rest of the banks all start feeling the effects of not enough money and seeing their balance sheets blow up in one way or another, and having to report horrible numbers and having people pull their money out because of that. That's the kind of thing that is virtually guaranteed unless we make some big change here. And there's apparently no big change coming, especially with today's inflation number. You know, that makes it almost impossible for the Fed to cut interest rates anytime soon. And it makes it really hard for them to even stop increasing rates. So that's the really, really macro meta view of what's going on right now. And that's almost all you need, because you know that that mathematically is going to cause a big problem in the not too distant future.
All right. So I follow that logic completely. A conversation that we've had on the site on this channel relatively, you know, of late is that all makes sense. So like, where are the defaults, right? You know, we jacked up interest rates faster and by a greater magnitude than we ever have before in history, at least within the short period of time in which we've jacked them up. And you know, we've had mortgage rates double. We all know that the system we have right now got accustomed, one could easily argue, addicted to kind of a ZERP world, right? And yet, yes, we had a correction last year, but like I said, markets are up against this year. There's a lot of people who are saying, yeah, everyone keeps telling me the housing market's going to correct, but in my area, you know, prices haven't come down. There's still bidding wars. So there's this, and we, in the press, we now have a huge debate over, you know, hey, it might not be a hard landing if we have a recession. There's more voices coming out for a soft landing or even no landing, right? People are arguing that we're going to be able to somehow skate by without going into recession. You know, showing my cards for a moment, you know, I personally ascribe to what you're saying there, John, but I understand that some people are asking hey, it hasn't happened yet. And if you had told me a year ago that the Fed was going to increase Fed funds rate by more than 500 basis points, and we were going to double mortgages and, you know, do QT and all this stuff, and we're going to have a banking crisis thrown in and all that stuff, I would have thought, you know, stock market would have had another correction, housing would be down way more than it is, but these things haven't happened. And I'm guessing you're going to say, yeah, they haven't happened yet, but why is it taking so long?
Well, that might be the single biggest question of most people's lives, right? why hasn't this happened yet? It should happen. And that's, yeah. that is kind of how life works. If it's something you really want, it takes a lot longer than it ought to happen. And, you know, for people who don't want a stock market crash and a recession, you know, it could go on forever and just be fine. But for the people who are watching for it, because we think based on past experience and, you know, the numbers as they are right now, that it should be happening and it's not happening, it's frustrating. But, you know, I can tell you that it's always been this way. At the peak of every cycle, especially now that we're firmly in bubble territory here, things that should happen don't happen for a really long time. Like just one example, back in the 1990s, I was a tech stock columnist for a online magazine called TheStreet.com. And I was kind of, you know, by 1998, I was kind of the resident bear. And so I used to get horrible hate mail from all the tech stock bubble guys and everything. But by 98, that bubble should have burst. All the numbers were crazy and there was no reason for it to keep going on, but it did. It went through 1999 and then through part of 2000 before it finally did blow up. This is like that, you know, this is something that should be happening. There's a lot of stuff in the background that kind of implies that it's going to happen soon, but it's not happening yet. But life is that way. It just takes longer than it should for a lot of things to happen. You know, let's go through some stats that kind of imply that it will happen pretty soon, because that's what I tend to look at. And I come away whenever I dig into the stuff that's behind the scenes, it seems clear that we are headed into some kind of a recession, if not something much worse. That, you know, whether it's much worse depends on how governments respond to it. And there's no clear, you know, way to know how they're going to respond to the next thing when it happens, because they're so spooked by inflation right now. But anyhow, you know, the short answer is that what should happen eventually does happen, just not always on the in the time frame that we think is logical and wish for. And this is just one of those times.
Okay. I mean, one of the answers that I've been hearing asking this question of others of late is, you know, we've had this pig through the python effect, right, where we just shoved an unprecedented amount of stimulus into the system, you know, in response to the pandemic. And, you know, eventually that stimulus will make its way through the system, that pig will exit the other end of the python. But some of the explanations have been that pig was so damn big, maybe we should even be calling it like a hippopotamus through the python, where it's just still going through it. Like it's delayed the reckoning, because we still have to get the remaining amount of stimulus out of the system before the system really can start rolling over due to the impacts that you and I are talking about. I'm just curious, do you think similarly or have a different opinion?
Well, yeah, we increased the money supply by between 40% and 60%, depending on which monetary measure you're using.
Just 2 years, right?
Yeah, in 2 years. Yeah, so. That accounts for the spike in home prices, for instance, and the fact that stocks went up so far during a recession and a pandemic. You would think that people would go risk averse in a time like that, but money was just so cheap that they went risk on, bought whatever they could buy, because that's what people do when they have too much money on their hands. By the way, RV sales boomed during that time too. Mm-hmm. It could well be that all of that money is still working its way through the system. But that is coming to an end now too. If you look at interest rates, for instance, car loans now, especially for used cars, are up in double digits.
14% record high.
Yes. Yeah. So that's not easy money anymore. Mortgage rates just this week hit 7% again, which make the average mortgage now accounts for 41% of the disposable income of the family that has the mortgage, which is way too high. You know, that's
way too high.
Yeah. And there are lots of other housing related stats pointing in that direction, but the money is no longer easy. And because of that, existing home sales are down by 23% year over year. And home prices are starting to fall. They're down by 4% year over year. And, or I'm sorry, 4% sequentially now, month over month. So we're seeing it start to happen. And it just hasn't worked its way into the very top line numbers yet. But housing is a big part of the economy. And if interest rates are too high for housing to really function, you know, you had a really good interview a few weeks ago where you had one of your resident experts interview another resident real estate expert. And they talked about housing as being frozen right now because, yeah, prices are really high, but there's very little inventory. People don't want to sell at these prices because they remember slightly higher prices in the recent past. And buyers can't buy here. You know, very few people can buy a $500,000 house with a 7% mortgage. That's just beyond the means of 70 or 80% of the country.
Right. And with anybody with a brain, you don't want to buy. Even if you could, because you're like, I'm still getting near record prices, right? I'm having to pay a very high price. And I've got a mortgage rate that's double what it was 2 years ago. So I'm getting the worst of both worlds. I'm getting the high price and I'm getting the high mortgage. Who would want to buy now?
Even if you can, it's a horrible deal compared to anything in your adult history, right? You remember 20 or 30 years when it was a better deal than this. So it's just hard to do. And, you know, that. The way it works in the housing market is that sales tend to dry up at a peak because of the factors we just talked about. But prices don't go down for a while. It's just fewer and fewer sales. And then people start to panic. People who have to sell put their house on the market for just whatever. And then there are all these empty houses out there. There's something like 10 times as many empty houses in the US as there are houses that are currently for sale. And a lot of those empty houses are there, Airbnb, or they're things where people bought them as an investment and whatever. But a lot of those people can be spooked by what's happening. They can have problems in their own lives and then have to sell the optional stuff, you know, the house that they're not living in. And when that hits the market, that will push prices down dramatically. So along with all this other stuff, you know, a rollover in the economy and a recession, we should see a big drop in house prices in the coming year.
And I'm glad you said that because you've seen a lot of cycles and you've written books, you know, about these cycles, one of your most recent ones being the money bubble. I like hearing your statements here because they're corroborating statements that I've made in the past, which is that, you know, we have a lot of folks, more, I think, than previous generations who own second homes and certainly the Airbnb, you know, boom encouraged people to buy many homes, right? To rent them out on Airbnb. And those are, you're not living in them, right? So if you personally enter tighter financial times, well, it's pretty easy to sell one of those properties, right? Because it's not essential to you. Yeah. Especially if it's an Airbnb and it's starting to go negative, right? You're like, yeah, just get this thing. Let me stop the bleeding. Let me just sell this thing, right? So when you have this sort of freeze in the market right now, transaction wise, right. It's right now that the sellers are just trying to see if they can hold on through this rough patch. Right. And then hopefully the Fed's going to pivot and we'll get back to the point where interest rates go back down and I'll be OK housing wise. Right. And prices will stabilize or come back to where they were. But the longer that doesn't happen. Right. There are going to always be some organic transactions. Right. The people die. They get divorced. They have to move, whatever. Right. And so because housing is priced at the margin. It's that percentage of organic transactions that are going to start to reset prices in these markets. And yes, sellers can hang in there for a certain period of time, but once you've got somebody who gets either enters into a distressed state or is just looking and seeing that the prices are starting to come down because of the organic sales, there's a first mover advantage, right? To bolt from the herd if you're a seller and say, well, look, if I do a price reduction now and get out, I can still get out with about 95% of what I have right now, right? So I can still get most of my equity in the house. I don't want to be one of the bag holders who's waiting, you know, later on once everybody else has started to sell. So people will start to bolt. And when that happens, I think it sort of becomes a scramble for the exit for anybody who was going to sell, right? Which is, well, geez, I better put my house in the market now because I'm going to get a better price this week than I will a month from now. And then you kind of get this cascade factor. Do you see it the same way?
Oh, yeah, that's how markets work at the peak. And because we have to remember that prices are set at the margin. In other words, with a house, if you sell your house for 10% less than the previous house in your neighborhood sold for, you've changed the comps in your neighborhood.
I've repriced every house. Yeah,
every house you have with that. And see, that's especially in a fiat currency system, that's how fast wealth can evaporate, because that one house, like you said, it made the whole rest of the neighborhood less valuable. So just that relatively little amount of money that changed hands had this massive multiplier effect, negative multiplier effect on the neighborhood. That's going to happen in the stock market when somebody decides to bail on a big position in Amazon or something like that. And then all of a sudden, $500 billion just evaporates. And when I short Nvidia and it plunges, yeah, that's going to be, you know, another $500 billion just gone. It's not like it goes anywhere. It just ceases to exist.
And this is an important point. I'm glad you mentioned it. I've referred to this in previous videos as money heaven. And I find that people don't really understand this so much. So to use your example of houses in a neighborhood, right? Let's say the houses, and there's 10 houses in the neighborhood. And after the past couple of years, when it's been a hot housing market, they're all now worth $1 million each, right? So the market value of all those houses in the neighborhood is now $10 million. Right. Then to use your example, somebody then sells their home for 10% less. All the other houses are repriced down. Right. It's not like, you know, we were at $10 million. Now the market value of the neighborhood is $9 million. It's not like that $1 million went into somebody else's pocket. Right. It just went poof. Right. Or technically, it's $900,000 that went poof, but it's nobody got it. It just literally was fantasy market value that probably wasn't merited. And once that new comp hits, it's just gone. Nobody got it. It went to money heaven.
Yeah. Another way of putting that is leverage is a two-edged sword. You know, it increases values across the board dramatically on the way up. And then those values and the wealth that was attached to those values just disappears on the way down. So yeah. If you're somebody who might want to buy a house now or 2 or 3 years from now, 2 or 3 years from now is going to be way better because that this process will have had a chance to work out where a huge amount of value will just evaporate. And then the people who are left selling will be just so panicked that they'll entertain lowball offers without being offended. And that's the time to be buying. So, I think we're headed into a time like that for definitely for financial assets like equities. The stocks are going to be much, much cheaper at some point in the not too distant future. And so will, you know, quasi financial assets like houses that you buy with a mortgage, just because that's how cycles work. You can go back through, the dot-com bust in 2000. There was a thing called the 90% Club there, where a lot of big name tech stocks went down 90% from their previous highs. And nobody got that money. That money just disappeared. And the same thing with houses in 2008, 2009. House prices in the US dropped by, what was the average? It was like 30% or something like that.
After
never having dropped since the Great Depression. I wrote a book on the housing bubble in 2003. Which was way early for that bubble bursting. But one of the criticisms I got, I'd go on, you know, radio shows and things like that, and they'd have somebody saying, but house prices never go down. You know, can you point to a time when house prices have gone down? And I would have to say, well, the 1930s, you know.
Yeah, it's ancient history.
Yeah. And, but then it happens eventually, you know, when things get too far out of whack, even things that never seem to go down. And to repeat the theme, we're headed for a time like that because we've inflated so many bubbles all at once that they're going to not just burst on their own, but they'll feed off of each other. And the end result will be that governments of the world will have to either let it burn, and I mean burn almost literally when this gets going, or step in and bail everything inside out at the cost of their currencies. So that's the big thing we've got coming, is this kind of sea change where governments lose the ability to bail everything out because their currencies are crashing. And yes, that hasn't happened for a really long time either, but it's another one of those things that is inevitable and very possibly imminent now, finally, after decades and decades of people being able to get away with doing things that they shouldn't have been able to get away with. Well, now the consequences are about to hit. And yeah, I think the next couple of years are going to be very different from the last couple, but equally stressful.
You know, it's so interesting about that too. You know, you've written, as you've said, about how we've the way in which this is structured is it's a process that sort of every cycle of rescue comes at the cost of the currency. And that, you know, in the end, they're going to be faced with that sort of binary decision of, yeah, you can nominally, you know, save or rescue the leverage system. But if you do that, it's really at the cost of your currency. You're going to destroy your currency in the process. And I think still for the average person, that's not something that they can just really fully imagine. Like, hey, this is the US, right? We're not Zimbabwe, right? The US, am I going to wake up and the US dollar is going to be toilet paper tomorrow? And I agree with them. I don't think it is. It's not going to be an overnight, you know, situation like that. But what is interesting is maybe for the first time, what's that old saying? Something about not one man in a million can notice the impact of inflation or something like that. It's this insidious thing that sort of slowly erodes at your purchasing power. But sometimes it happens fast enough that you can start to see it. And, you know, we've just come off the massive stimulus response from the pandemic. And lo and behold, you know, we've had this massive inflation. And so, you know, our dollars basically buy, depending upon the good or service that you're looking at, I mean, they buy anywhere from 10 to 30% less than what they did just in 2019. Right. I mean, if you're talking about food at the supermarket, or you're talking about the gas you put in your car, or a number of other things I could list through, the rent you pay, whatever, like healthcare, like those things are all up way more than 20% since the end of 2019 today. So it actually isn't this sort of crazy academic, you know, theory that John's mentioning that, oh, the currency might get destroyed. Like, we can look back at the past 2.5 years and be like, wow, our currency took a pretty major hit.
Yeah, that's what's going to be different about the next round of gigantic bailouts is people are actually able to conceive of inflation now, because you had to go all the way back to the 1970s to have unruly inflation that was actually dangerous and scary.
And in the US, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but we do have people watching from other countries who are probably saying, hey, buddy, here in our country, we noticed it all. But yes.
Yeah, that's true. There are other countries who have experienced bouts of inflation, but in general, in the developed world, currencies have depreciated, but not in a disorderly way. So it was hard to conceive of a disorderly decline in the value of the currency. In other words, prices really spiking in ways that hurt you. And now we can conceive of that. The last couple of years have showed people that, you can literally not be able to get toilet paper, or eggs might be $7 a dozen. You know, right. That kind of thing actually happened to people. So it's part of their lived experience. And it was, you know, it was the result of the governments stepping in and bailing out the economy in a really big way. So the next time that happens, maybe the, you know, the banks or the insurance companies or whoever start to run into trouble, and the government has to step in, and the number is $5 trillion or something like that, which they could have gotten away with back in the housing bust of the 2010s or the 2000s. Now people are going to look at that and they're going to think, instead of, oh, the government is going to save us, they're going to think, okay, what will that do to inflation? In other words, is the dollar really just going to fall off the table now? You know, I'm just barely able to put food on the table for the kids right now. And is this going to make it worse in a way where I have to choose between driving to work, paying rent, and feeding my kids? You know, is that what's going to happen now? And that's going to be a whole different thing, because people will kind of see this coming. They won't be blindsided by it. They'll be anticipating it. And if they act accordingly, which is to say, if they start converting their cash into real stuff, because they're worried about their cash becoming less valuable, And they have perceived that real things hold their value. In other words, land, gold and silver, energy stocks, things like that, that governments can't make more of. You know, if they perceive that to be the case and they start acting accordingly, then we get this massive shift in capital that still leads to a declining currency, but also leads to big jumps in maybe oil prices, maybe uranium, definitely gold and silver, things like that. So in other words, there's an investment thesis in all of this. It's not just, oh my God, the world's ending. You know, the thing that you draw from this is that there could be a huge mass reaction to the next gigantic bailout. And it could lead to capital flows going in a very different direction. And we could anticipate that by buying ahead of that. So I think that's what we should take away from this, that there are some serious opportunities here. You know, I think uranium stocks just, they've actually been doing pretty well, even when everything else hasn't been lately. Or in the commodity space, things haven't been lately. And I think there's a reason for that. And
great. Well, let's look, folks are going to say, Adam, just dig away with John here on this. So let's dig into this. So let's start with uranium stocks. So why are you so particularly bullish about them?
Okay. Well, first, they fall into the category of hard assets, real things that governments can't make more of. They emphatically can't get more uranium. But over the past couple of decades, especially since the Fukushima accident in Japan, governments have been moving away from nuclear power as their, you know, their green energy plans. They didn't include nuclear in that. In fact, just the opposite. They started closing down nuclear plants and just mothballing existing ones and closing down plans on future plants. And that made the demand for uranium go way down and the price went way down. But in the past few years, it's been the case that a lot of the alternative energy sources that governments shifted towards didn't work out quite as well. For instance, Germany went big time into solar and wind, but it turns out that's a cloudy, not very windy country. And so those things didn't work nearly as well as expected. And then the natural gas pipelines they contracted for with Russia, we know how that went.
That went, right. Sorry to interrupt, but they also decommissioned their nuclear plants at the same time they were doing all this.
Yeah, they did that. That's right. And so a lot of countries are perceiving that process to be a mistake now. And so they're reversing gear. And they're taking their nuke plants out of mothball, and they're building new plants. And just China, I think, has 20 or 30 new nuclear plants on the drawing board that are, you know, in the process, one stage or another, of being built. And there is no way that the current output from today's nuclear or uranium mines can satisfy all the demand that is likely in the next 5 to 10 years if all of these plans turn out to be put into place. So you've got the potential for a huge shortage of uranium out there. So you've got a thing that's real, the governments can't make more of, they can't inflate it away, and the demand for it is rising dramatically faster than the supply of it right now. So how do you get higher supply in a situation like that? Well, prices have to go up to lead miners to bring more properties online. In other words, you know, if something is marginal at today's prices, it's very profitable at twice today's prices. So that's what we'll see in that space. You know, barring some kind of huge discontinuity, like a nuclear war, or, you know, some kind of massive depression starting soon. And those things are not impossible. So that means uranium isn't a guarantee. But if you look at just the trends that are in place right now, it's really attractive. And same thing with oil. We're going to need, believe it or not, more petroleum going forward. And there's less and less of it around. Same thing with copper. We need way more copper to build out the electric infrastructure that everybody is planning. All the governments of the world seem to think we can have 50% electric cars on the market or on the road in just another half decade or a full decade at least. But where does the copper come from all that, for all that? Because an electric car takes several times as much copper as an internal combustion engine car does. Where does it come from? Well, that's not clear. You know, it has to be at a much higher price to bring on enough new copper production capacity to make that possible. So there's another highly likely investment thesis. A lot of stocks out there that are very cheap compared to what they will be if the price of the underlying commodity goes way up. So, you know, there's a lot of great stories like this out there. And gold and silver, of course. We've talked about that every time you and I have talked about why and how gold and silver should be a lot higher than they are now and why they're going through the roof. And nothing has changed. In fact, it's gotten a lot better lately for silver, because silver has suddenly gone into deficit. In other words, the world's silver mines and the mines that produce silver as a byproduct aren't producing enough to cover demand, and we're running through inventories. Well, once those inventories are gone, then we go from a deficit to a shortage, in which prices have to rise to incent miners to find more silver or to cause users of silver to stop using it. That's less likely right now at anything around today's prices. So silver has to go way up to make this work. And it hasn't even really started yet. So there's a lot of stories out there that are very exciting in this kind of a world, in a fiat currency world that's falling apart. You know, you end up with a lot of things that that ought to do really well through that process. And the key to protecting yourself and your family and maybe even profiting from all of this is just to position yourself so that you're there when these big price moves start happening. And, you know, it's a very straightforward thing to do. And on my Substack, that's one of the things that we do. We're setting up portfolios of uranium stocks and gold and silver miners and copper stocks. So far, so. You know, some of them have gone up, some of them have gone down. But the macro story for those sectors still looks great.
All right, great. And, been working up in this discussion to ask people how they can take action on this and get ideas of which particular companies to invest in or ETFs or whatever, however you're playing this. So we'll give a little preview. Sounds like go subscribe to your Substack and they can actually see what you're recommending there, or recommending that people look at. It's not personal financial advice on your end, but it's you're putting these portfolios out there for people to consider. We'll tell people in just a moment exactly where to go to get your Substack, John. Got so many notes I took while you were talking there. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get through all of them in the time we have left here. But on the precious metals side of things specifically, I know that you know, there's commercial uses. So there's similar commercial demand elements like you had for some of the other assets that you mentioned. But obviously, they have the monetary side as well. And in a fiat world where the purchasing power of the fiat currencies is being eroded due to higher inflation, obviously precious metals make even more sense as a monetary form in which to store the value of your money and protect your purchasing power. Lots of ways to invest in precious metals, from owning the metals directly to owning the companies that mine them, et cetera. And I know that you follow the mining space really closely, and that's where you can have your biggest gains. But I'm curious, right now, you know, gold has done pretty well. It was close, you know, if we'd been talking a couple of weeks ago, it was right up near its all-time high. Now it's kind of sold off a bit by about $100 an ounce or so. Silver hadn't really quite done as well as gold did this year, and it's now selling off a little bit harder. But the mining companies haven't really been keeping pace with the metal prices this cycle, like they have, you know, on average in past cycles. And so I'm wondering, are you seeing right now like a particularly good time to be buying into the mining space for the precious metals miners because they're relatively underperforming right now?
Yeah, the mining space is a really interesting story right now. I'll hit the high points. One is that when the underlying commodity, in other words, gold and silver versus the gold miners and silver miners, when it starts to go up, it takes people a while to look beyond just, hey, I'm going to get some gold and silver coins, or I'm going to buy this ETF that owns a lot of gold and silver, to the miners, because they're more complicated and a little bit forbidding to a lot of people. So it takes them a while to get going. Once they do get going, and once, for instance, people have made a lot of money in gold and silver bullion, or that ETF that just buys a bunch of bullion and puts it in a vault, then they think, okay, I'm a genius. I got this right. Now, how can I make even more?
How can I turbocharge?
Yeah, exactly. And so they look around for other things and they find the miners, which are generally referred to as leveraged bets on the underlying metal. In other words, they have operating leverage so that if the price of what they're selling goes up by 10%, their operating profits might go up by 50%. And so the miners can go up a lot more quickly than the thing that they're mining in good times. But you got to have those good times go on for a while to get people excited. So I think that's part of what's holding the miners back now. But there's another more ominous reason that they're not doing well. And that is that a lot of governments around the world are starting to view the extractive industries as kind of pots of gold, you know, as sources of revenue. And they're changing the laws that apply to gold, silver, copper miners, oil companies, so that the government gets a bigger cut of whatever a miner makes within that country. And that's changing the profitability calculus for a lot of these companies. And, you know, it's especially true in copper right now, where copper mines are these big, gigantic operations that are very visible. And governments, where some of the biggest copper miners operate, are starting to tighten the rules and ask for more money. And that's changing the potential profitability of these companies. And that's something we really got to look into. We got to run the numbers and figure out how big a deal this is, and whether it fundamentally changes how we should perceive these companies. Because it's possible that maybe the best way to play commodities is just the physical ETFs. In other words, buy stock in something that just like the uranium trust that Sprott runs, where they go and they get literal uranium and store it somewhere. And then you own a piece of that pile of uranium. And so you just, you profit as uranium's price goes up. You don't have to worry about government action and political risk and things like that with the miners. So it's possible that the best portfolio in the commodity space now is the best quality physical ETFs. And maybe the streaming companies and the royalty companies, because they aren't as directly affected by governments changing the rules.
Right.
So we need to think about this. It's not a guarantee one way or the other, but it's definitely a thing to look into and to come to a conclusion about.
Yeah, I've told people often on this program that if you're going to be investing in the mining space, unless you've got a ton of history yourself, it's much better to you know, sort of follow an expert. And there's a lot of folks out there that have their own newsletters where they're, you know, they're the ones that have relationships with these companies. They're talking to the senior management. They're experienced in looking through drill results and things like that. Sometimes, you know, they go and do the mine tours themselves. Like it's a complex industry to understand. And, you know, there's a lot of companies just aren't going to make it, particularly down at the explorer side, right? So you want somebody who's got a lot of seasoned experience being able to separate the wheat from the chaff there. Now you're introducing even more risks now onto the table here in terms of country risk and government risk and stuff like that. And so I think it's just, you're just making that argument even more important in my mind, which is, hey, you know, if you're just a regular armchair investor, you really want to be leveraging the people who are, you know, leaning into the space 24/7 and really understanding what's going on here, because it can be really easy as a regular person just to miss a lot of this stuff if you're just picking stocks on your own. So one more reason for people to go check out your Substack, which we'll get to in just a second, John. Real quick, I'm just looking, we're getting a little short on time. So I want to do a little bit of a lightning round with you if we can, just to sort of fully complete the context for people. So much of what we talked about here prior to talking about these assets, these opportunities and hard assets, you know, it sounds like you're pretty pessimistic about where both the economy and the markets are headed from here. In terms of the economy, what sort of odds do you give us of going into a recession in the next year? And if so, if they're good, how severe a recession are you expecting this time around as the everything bubble, you know, really starts to unwind here? Is this going to be a mild recession, a moderate recession, or maybe a severe recession?
I think it's highly likely that we get a recession in the coming year, just because so many things have already turned down with nothing on the horizon to make them turn back up again. And as for how bad it is, the numbers are horrendous. I mean, we're just so insanely over-indebted and over-leveraged at this point that there's a lot of things that can just blow up and then be the first domino that knocks all the other dominoes down. So it could be really, really bad. And part of the near-term decision-making process that'll determine what happens is, what will the governments of the world do when things start to roll over? And we saw what the U.S. did already here with, a couple of banks went bust. It's just that they had runs because their bond portfolios didn't do so well with higher interest rates. That caused paper losses on some of their bonds, and they had to report that, and that scared depositors. And, it wasn't even anything that serious, but the government had to step in and offer a guarantee for basically all bank deposits, which is several trillion dollars.
Right. That's a very big backstop.
That is a very big backstop. Yeah. And now we're, taxpayers are on the hook for this stuff if more banks start to fail. But then you've got insurance companies, which own massive amounts of, for instance, commercial real estate and bonds, both of which are in bad shape right now. And they're not going to be doing as well. And a lot of big insurance companies, well, at least they used to own a lot of derivatives. I don't know if that's still the case, but the big money center banks in the U.S. have massive derivatives books, which are derivatives are very obscure, opaque bets that banks and hedge funds make with each other in order to generate fees that in total notional value are looking at like half a quadrillion dollars.
It's
just so huge. So something like that, I mean, already in 2009, if the government didn't step in and bail out the derivatives books of the big banks, they all would have ceased to exist. JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, they would not be here today if the government hadn't stepped in and bailed them out with trillions of dollars of at least guarantees and things. Wouldn't it be a better world today if it allowed that to happen? A world without Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase would be a much saner world. But we're still looking at that or something similar. We haven't fixed anything, but that was involved in that last crisis. So all of this stuff could happen again. So I think that the most likely scenario is that some of this, some of these possible crises become real. They happen. The government steps in and bails them out. And then the question is, what does that do to the currency market and the global bond market? And we'll have to see. I mean, I think it's completely possible that it spooks the financial asset markets in a way that is uncontrollable, and that leads us to some kind of a big crash that leads us to the big currency reset that we've been talking about for such a long time. So it's completely possible that that's the next stage of this process. And it could be, if they get it wrong, I mean, if they make things worse with government responses to these things, then it could be the worst thing we've seen in our lifetime. Certainly, it could be something like a combination of the Great Depression and Weimar Germany or something like that, very easily based on the numbers.
Wow. Okay, that's a big statement. To the person who says, things start going off the rails, the government just comes in, they do an even bigger rescue than they did before. What's the big deal, John? They'll just keep doing that every time they need to. What's your response to that? I mean, presumably every time that they have to reinsert themselves, they have to do an even bigger type of rescue. And of course, that makes an even bigger hit on the currency. So I don't want to make the argument for you, but I guess my question is, how many times do you think they can rescue this system using the playbook that they've been using before we have this currency forced reset that we've long talked about?
Well, I thought the Great Recession was basically the end of the road for the fiat currency system. So I was wrong about that. They managed to buy us another decade. But it was at a cost of rising inflation in the last year or two. And now that was partially due to the pandemic lockdowns too. But the last big set of bailouts led to a serious currency issue. And if the next big set of bailouts is even bigger than the last, then it follows that the currency consequences would be bigger too. And it would also be something that people are looking for. They're not blindsided by it anymore because that's what happened last time. So they're looking for the same thing that happened last time to happen this time. So you get a market reaction at the same time the government is doing things that may or may not screw up the currency. So I think it's completely possible that the inflation that we saw in the last couple of years could recur, but on a bigger scale. And the shift in asset prices or the shift in capital that we saw in the 2009 to 2011 timeframe, when everybody piled into gold and silver, that could happen again, but on a much bigger scale. So I think a lot of what is likely to happen is going to be stuff that's already happened, but bigger. And the question is it big enough to completely break everybody's faith in the system itself? And I think that's conceivable. I think we get something like the crack-up boom from the Austrian School of Economics, where things just kind of spin out of control and people give up on the currency. And, we weren't that far from that when we were having toilet paper shortages in Costco. People were just buying everything they could think of. In other words, they were handing their currency over to buy real stuff because they didn't trust their currency to be able to buy them real stuff 3 months into the future or whatever. That was on a very small scale compared to what could happen when people just take that idea and extend it across the board in their lives. And eventually that's what's coming. So it could be this time, the numbers are big enough. Or it could be that they buy us some more time by doing some really extreme bailout, and that I don't know. And at the same time that's happening, regardless, they're going to be using the crisis to institute a lot of things they couldn't get away with otherwise, because that's when the central bank digital currency becomes mandatory, right? And who knows if there's another pandemic and they decide that vaccine mandates just become global law or something like that. There could be a lot of things that that happen because there's a crisis and people with the power to impose their will decide they want to use that crisis in order to get some other things done. So there's going to be that added complication, which is inherently unpredictable, but will add to the stress that everybody's feeling at the time. So, yeah. See, hopefully we're all feeling that stress. We're all watching this crazy stuff happen. But at the same time, we're online looking at our brokerage account and seeing, oh, okay, my oil stocks are up another 20% this week. We're getting that kind of psychological compensation of being right about our investments while the world is getting more and more stressful. So that's what we have to hope for. I mean, I don't think we can hope for a non-stressful world, because the money that we've borrowed makes that out of impossible. But we can hope for some offsets because of the good decisions that we made leading into the next big bout of societal stress. And I think that's what we should be shooting for. We want to be doing things right now either make us immune to what's going on or in some way allow us to profit from it.
All right. Well, really well said. I'm going to disappoint people by not digging into a few of the things that you mentioned there, like CBDCs, just because we're over time at this point. So we'll have to tackle that next time you come on, John. But to your point there, which is right in the bullseye of Wealthion's mission, right, which is helping people position prudently today, given where things may head. You've given us, a great detailed and somewhat, concerning, frightening, scary picture of where things may be headed from here. For folks that want to be positioning themselves prudently and potentially in many of the things that you mentioned, more in the hard asset space there, Where can they go to follow you and be able to, you know, continue to see your evolving thinking on this? Sounds like that's your Substack.
Yeah, my Substack is rubino.substack.com, and there are different ways to sign up. You can get a free subscription and you get most of what I publish, and then a paid subscription, which covers a lot of the actionable stuff, like the portfolios we're setting up and specific ways to short the market and things like that. I guess that's it.
All right. Well, look, it's been wonderful to see. So, I mean, John, I've followed your work and known you forever now. I mean, it's been definitely over a decade since we first met. It's crazy that the time has gone that fast. But obviously, you know, huge, big fan of you and your work. It was fun that you announced basically your Substack on this channel earlier this year. And it's great to see how quickly it has grown in just a few short months. So kudos to you on that, entirely well-deserved. And to anybody who's enjoyed this conversation with John and is potentially interested in following his insights, I can't recommend enough going to the Substack and subscribing. All right, John, well, look, this has been wonderful. Folks watching, in addition to going and checking out John's Substack, if you're relatively new to this channel, you know, one of the things I talk about in almost every video is the wisdom of working under the guidance of a professional financial advisor who understands all these macro issues and risks and challenges that John mentioned. And to be honest, there are relatively few out there that do, that are even willing to admit them and think about them, but even fewer that then put that information as inputs into their portfolio management. Highly recommend you find one who does and can build a personalized financial plan for you and then execute it for you. And if you've got one who's doing that for you, congratulations, you should definitely stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion of one who does, consider talking to one of the financial advisory firms that Wealthion endorses. Have a free consultation with them. To set one up, just go to wealthion.com. It's totally free. It doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a public service they offer to help as many people as possible position smartly, given what might be coming down the pike. And John has given us, you know, a lot of things to consider that may be coming. All right, John. Well, look, this has been fantastic. Folks, if you'd like to have John come back on again soon and get into some of the other topics we didn't get into today, like the CBDCs, do me a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Always fun, John. You're welcome to come back on this channel anytime you want to. Thanks so much for coming on this week. It's been a great discussion.
Thanks, Adam. Talk to you soon.